your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
We do lots of learning on the fly, by ourselves, or on the job. We may be learning software or management skills, even how to procrastinate less. Are there not obvious keys to learning better? And if part of our job is to teach our coworkers or supervisees, are there not obvious keys to helping other people learn better? To help address those questions, my guest is Julie Dirksen. She has created learning experiences for organizations from nonprofits to startups to Fortune 500 companies and is the author of Design for How People Learn, now in its second edition. Julie Dirksen, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with procrastination. It plagues so many people, and job seekers are particularly likely to procrastinate. Do you have any not obvious advice about how they can learn to procrastinate less?
Yeah, procrastination is a favorite problem of mine because it's such an interesting behavior change challenge. Even when people really, really, really don't want to procrastinate, mm-hmm. they still have trouble with it. Mm-hmm. And it's fundamentally a hyperbolic discounting problem, which is a concept from behavioral economics. It comes from the research of people like Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and I can explain it really simply in a couple of questions. So the first question is if I was handing out money, would you agree that most people would probably take, if I was handing out $10 or $11, most people would probably take the $11, right?
Right.
Yeah. So more money is a better thing if I was handing out money. But the second version of the question is a little bit different. That question is, if I'm handing out $10 today or $11 tomorrow, mm-hmm. then it becomes a question of which one would you take. So if I was offering that to you, Marty, which one would you take?
Well, I would take the 11 tomorrow, yes, but right. Do procrastinators take the 10 now?
Yeah, pretty much. And when I ask big groups of people that question, I get a pretty even split. Like I'll get 50-50 or 60-40. Some people want the money now, and other people are willing to make use of that impulse control in their prefrontal cortex and decide to sacrifice current benefit for future gain, which is kind of our ideal circumstance.
Hey, you know what? 10% on a one day, 10% per day is like the world's greatest investment. If I wouldn't make that, I'd be crazy, it would seem.
Right, right. Yeah, no. It's a good deal. But if the third version of the question is, if I offered you $10 today or $11 in a year, which one would you take?
Well, you know, it depends on how much I needed $10. If I needed it to, you know, to buy my medication, I'd probably take the 10 now. But I'm still glad to have a 10% yield on my return a year from now. So I would.
Yeah, and you're probably my outlier. So when I ask that question,
everybody says that, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, go ahead.
When I ask that of a big group of people, almost everybody will take the $10 today, except I'll get maybe one person who holds out, and he usually wants to talk to me about interest rates. So you're my outlier in that circumstance.
What's the rationale? What do people say that justifies them turning down a 10% return, guaranteed 10% return?
You know, we don't get into reasons too much, but uncertainty can be part of it. If I get the $10 today, I know I'm really going to get it, as opposed to if I wait a year. You know, you would have to have a secure sort of trusted relationship for that.
Right. I guess if the FDIC was insuring it, then I'd be okay with it, I bet. But if Joe Blow on the street were, then maybe I would take the 10 now. Bird in the hand is worth two in the bush kind of thing. Okay. So what does this have to do with curing? Our focus here, dear listeners who are just joining us, we're trying to figure out, are there smarter ways to learn things that help you on the job? And so procrastination is one of those things that a lot of people need to learn or at least change their behavior. And so Julie Dirksen is trying to tell me what all this has to do with my teaching myself or others how to procrastinate less. What's the deal?
Right. So what it happens is the further out a reward or a consequence is, so either a positive reward or a negative consequence, the sort of more we discount the value of that, which is where the term comes from. And so if I push something out, if I get a reward immediately, it's the most valuable. And as soon as I start to push it out into the future, then I start to value it less and less. So, you know, the oh gosh, the benefit for exercising, for example, is, you know, I'm much healthier. That's a pretty big benefit, but I'm not going to see any of those benefits for
sure.
Like 4 to 6 weeks.
Let's stay with career, though. Let's say the typical situation that people procrastinate about is they have a report they've got to write, and it's a pain in the butt. You got to look at a lot of spreadsheets, and you got to analyze sheaves of data and all the rest of it. And so you say, I think I'll get a burrito. Okay, so
right.
So
well,
now what do I do? So how are you going to...
job hunting, you know, which is our original kind of scenario,
okay.
This sort of job hunting issue, this is I need to work on my resume tonight, or I need to apply for jobs tonight, but my reward is somewhere out in the future. Maybe I'll get an interview, maybe I'll get a job. And so one of the big tricks for this is to create some reward that you get much closer to now. It doesn't have to be very big. But, you know, it could be making a deal with yourself of, if I finish revising the first part of my resume, I get to watch my, you know, I get to watch Game of Thrones without guilt or something like that.
I get to eat that burrito.
Yeah, I get to eat that burrito, right? And so if I can create some way that this is rewarding right now, Michelle Segar, who's a researcher at the University of Michigan, has looked into this pretty heavily with exercise. And she talks about reframing exercise not as a chore but a gift, something I get to do, and focusing on what do I get out of it today. If I take a walk today, I'll be more relaxed is an immediate reward, as opposed to if I take walks, I'll, you know, get in shape. So if we look at that from a job hunting point of view, what are rewards that I can get out of this right now? What can be satisfying to me today about these tasks or this thing that I do?
You know, Jim, you know? Julie, my honest reaction is that's like old news. Everybody knows we need short-term rewards. You know, you give it, you know, you say, okay, if you clean your plate or you finish eating, I'll let you watch TV. You didn't say in 2, you know, you don't tell the kid in 2 weeks, I'm, you know, you can have some bazooka bubble gum. So is this just the same old, we all give each other rewards and we wouldn't get up to work to go to the morning if we didn't get paid, many of us. So is it just the same old thing, just get yourself short-term rewards? Is that the message?
You know, we are pretty good at doing this with kids. I think we're less good at doing it with adults and with ourselves. The other piece of it is just really looking at the question of, instead of looking forward to some new method that you haven't tried before, ask yourself the question of what's historically worked for me in the past. Because different people actually need different motivators around these kinds of things. I'll tell you personally, the only thing that works for me is social accountability. If I don't owe something to somebody, it's not going to get done. And so being able to kind of look through and say, well, what has worked in the past? How can I construct a scenario where I have that same situation in my current structuring it around, if it's social accountability, how can I find the person that I can be accountable to who's not going to let me off the hook, who's actually going to hold me accountable? You know, those are the kinds of things. Or structuring environments.
What does that mean? What is structuring environments? What does that mean?
Structuring your environment. So structuring your environment is looking for all of the things that maybe derail you from working on your task. So there's all of the little software blockers right now that'll shut down the rest of the internet while you work on your task. So, you know, you can use a blocker that'll, you know, shut down Facebook and shut down Twitter and shut down whatever the kinds of things are for you that tend to be distractions. So can you put yourself into circumstances where really the only options you have are to work on the thing that you're trying to avoid?
Yeah, what motivates me really is fear. We're trained, psychologists train us, and all the MBA programs now train us that we need to be positive and positive reinforcement or whatever. But at least for me, if somebody tells me, you know, you write this report by tomorrow or your job is on the line, I am far more likely to write that damn report than to say, you know, I really would love to see that report at 9 in the morning tomorrow. You'd be very proud of yourself. That'd be right. Do you have a sense at all, or empirical data, to talk about the role of positive rewards, which is what you were talking about, versus fear, and the implications of that for management, for people who are trying to get other people, their supervisees, to not procrastinate?
Right, yeah. So the more immediate the consequence in those circumstances, too, because when you've got direct reports who are procrastinating and you let them get away with it, the message to them, their visceral experience of this is, you know, they said this, but they didn't really mean it. And so whenever we've got that that contrast between what people are saying and what people are actually doing, then we're going to have a problem for it. So, like, if you show up, your new job, and you're supposed to be there by 9 a.m., and you come by 9 a.m. the first week, but then the second week you show up at 9:15, and nobody says anything, then your visceral experience tells you 9:15 is fine. Nobody's going to give you a hard time about it.
Right.
Same thing with procrastinating. If you're supposed to write that report and you don't write it and there's no consequence to it, then, you know, everybody in the room has learned that, it's okay. You don't actually have to get it done by the deadline.
Right. That's a kind of a silent, passive not following through. But, you know, just yesterday I was seeing, I was walking my doggy, my Einstein, there was a mom, and there was a kid who, a little boy, maybe 5 years old, who was on his scooter. And the kid was maybe, 30 feet ahead. And the mother said, "If you don't come right back here, I'm going to leave you." Well, you know, is she really going to leave the kid? No. That's clearly going to be an idle threat. So if the kid chose to not come right back, then the kid doesn't begin to trust that the mother in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's true also of bosses. These idle threats things are particularly tempting because you want to lay out the maximum pressure. You know, you're going to be fired if you don't get this report, and then you don't get fired. Well, not only does that supervisee realize that those are empty threats, but it also sends a message to the rest of the coworkers that this boss is a bunch of hot air. Let's let our listeners know. You listen to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Julie Dirksen. She is the author of Design for How People Learn. And we're talking about common situations in the workplace. We talked about procrastination. Let's turn to a very common situation where people have been an individual contributor, and then they get promoted to be a manager. And they've got to learn on the job. A lot of people get promoted to manager, and if they didn't get an MBA or even a certificate program in management, they may have read a couple of articles or whatever. And you, in your book, you offer the example of Mariana. How did Mariana effectively learn on the job to be a good manager?
Right. Well, so she's in a position where she's now managing her, you know, former coworkers, which is a tough place to be in. Mm-hmm. And in the scenario in the book, she's put into, you know, one of those sort of standard managerial training classes, might be a couple of days. But one of the big problems or one of the big difficulties we have with a lot of managerial training is that we sort of just tell people some stuff. We treat it as an information gap. So if we think about what's different between where they are now and where they need to be, most of the time it's not really an information problem. Good managers, you know, versus bad managers, it tends to be a gap in their skills, or it tends to be a gap in their habits. It tends to be a gap in maybe some motivation issues around, you know, having hard conversations and, you know, shying away from conflict or things like that. So usually information isn't going to fix the situation. What we probably need for manager training is something that looks a little bit less like, you know, college classroom, and a little bit more like basketball camp, which is this sort of environment where they really know how to do kind of intense skills training. You may drill and practice on a particular thing, and then you may scrimmage, and then you may
learn some
theory.
Let's be specific. Let's forget the metaphor. Let's be specific. Let's say I am a new manager, and I basically have to teach myself all those things, you know, how to handle conflict, how to run a meeting, how to set expectations, how to inspire people, how to get somebody who was previously my coworker, and now I've got to get them to respect me without them thinking I'm being high and mighty. Okay, now, what, given, you know, you've written the book in its second edition, Design for How People Learn, how do I, if I am Mariana, how do I learn those things on the job, specifically?
Right. Well, probably one of the more effective things that Mariana could do if somebody else doesn't do it for her is to find a good mentor who can provide feedback on the actions that they're taking right now. Because that's one of the biggest problems that people have in learning environments is they don't really get enough feedback on their efforts. So they don't find out. They can try things, but they don't necessarily find out what works and what doesn't work. So you can either get feedback through an expert coach who can kind of watch you do things and give you feedback and pointers and so forth, or you can get feedback by seeing what are the results of your actions. So, for example, if you're trying to deal with the problem of, you know, managing people who used to be your coworkers, then asking the question of, if I'm doing this well, what is this going to look like? What indicators should I see in the environment that are going to tell me I'm moving closer versus moving further away from accomplishing this goal, and then start tracking based on different actions that you take, which ones are closer to producing the result that you want to see and which ones are moving you further away from the results that you want to see.
I'm curious what you think of them. I'm not disagreeing. I'm going to amplify and kind of put a little flesh on that skeleton. If I were starting out as a manager, I would look for three separate things to help me become a better manager. Number one, as you say, I take an experimental approach to my management style, and I am looking very carefully at the responses that I'm getting from my supervisees. Subtle things. Even the fact that maybe they used to be happy to chat with me, and now I'm seeing them move as they're chatting with me, moving their foot away toward the door. I'm sensing there's something going wrong. Or I'm seeing their facial expression. I see them sigh or whatever. I'm trying different approaches. I'm being experimental and seeing what's seeming to work, what's getting better results, what's getting them to do their work more and procrastination less. What's getting them to work a little longer? What's getting them to be willing to be bold in a meeting and disagree with me, which is a good thing. So some of it is simply the experimental attitude I would take. Secondly, I would, as you said, I would find somebody in the workplace who understands the culture in that workplace, who's a really beloved, I love the word beloved, a beloved manager, if there is one, or at least the closest to that I could find, and say, hey, by any chance, could I ask you to shadow me for a half hour, an hour, or whatever, and give me in the moment, just in time, feedback on what I'm doing well or what you think I might try to do differently? And the third thing, it would be kind of what I would hold in reserve, the nuclear option. If I felt that wasn't working well, then yes, I probably would bring in somebody who was a real pro at management coaching, somebody who was great at it, who maybe, the kind of person who'd be available would be a retired, beloved manager who would love to feel like his or her skin is still in the game a little bit and be happy to pay them to shadow me for a whole day. What do you think of my three-legged stool plan for becoming a manager on the job?
I love it, because a lot of the things that make somebody a good manager are hard to kind of talk about in principles, but when you see actual examples, people can be like, okay, here's the specific thing that you did that you may want to think about differently, and that kind of feedback would be incredibly valuable for any manager.
Okay. Let's turn to another thing that people are having to learn on the job all the time. It's software. So let's say you're trying to get your coworkers or your supervisees to use that new nifty project management software. What are some of the keys to making that work?
Yeah, well, a lot of the training material for something like software or whatever, it tends to focus on this is what the product is. This is why the product's great. This is all the things that the product does. But really, everybody who's in your audience doesn't really care at all. What they care about is being good at project management, or they care about solving problems that they have. So if we take this software training and we actually structure it around those kinds of variables, how can our software help you be better at your job? How can our software solve problems that you have? Then all of a sudden, instead of kind of people sort of sitting there and forcing themselves to go through the really tedious forms of, okay, here's how I print a document over here, and here's how I set up this table and things like that, all of a sudden they're actually engaged in figuring out how can they accomplish their goals. We want them to be the superhero of their own story, we're not looking for people to become massive advocates for your software unless they can also see how that software helps them be better at what they're doing.
That was a phrase I really liked in your book, make people a hero of their own story. It seems like that's prerequisite to even teaching them anything. So let's concretize that. Let's say I am having to teach my supervisees whiz-bang version 8.0 of this cool new project management software. How do I go about, as prerequisite to teaching them the bits and bytes of that software, how do I make people the hero of their own story? What does that mean?
Yeah, well, one of the ways you can do that is you can structure the training material around the problems that they bring to the table. So rather than sort of saying, these are the things I think are important about the software, you say, what are the things that are important to you? What are the problems you're trying to solve? What are the things you're having difficulty with? Okay, we're going to take a look at how this tool can potentially help you resolve some of those problems. Because then you have people, instead of people sort of forcing themselves to sit through your training, you have people who are like, oh, this is actually going to help me. This is actually going to solve problems that I need to solve and you really don't have nearly as big a challenge with engagement. And also, you know, a friend of mine's a game designer, and he talks about how the goal of game design, as far as he's concerned, isn't entertainment. It's to make people feel smart. And the goal of
that's a lot of learning. Dear listeners, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I really believe that people in general, whether you're a job interviewee, your part of your job is to make your interviewers appear smart. If you are on the job and you're a manager, part of your job is to make people feel smart without BSing, but by really looking for ways to structure situations that with moderate difficulty, they can succeed. That's true of a video game, and it's true of their projects. Make sense? Continue.
Yeah. So I feel like my training programs are successful if people walk out of it feeling like they've got a whole new set of superpowers that they can use to bring to bear on things that have been a problem or things that have been a challenge or things that they've not felt they've really been tackling very well. If they can leave going, oh, I have ideas for things that I can do with this, and I feel like I have new capabilities I didn't have before, then that's really, you know, generally what I'm trying to accomplish when in most of the learning environments that I design.
Well, so a variation on this, what you were talking about, is a way of making them the hero of their own story. You said have them use their own project. Now, I can understand that, certainly. If I'm trying to teach an individual person, maybe I could do that even as a group. Maybe you're right. Okay, so that principle is if I'm teaching five people to use the software, and they each maybe have their own project, I would say, you know, the hell with learning these tactics and these commands in the abstract. Okay, let's take out your project right now. The way you're currently handling it is with your mechanically or with some antiquated software. Okay, so put down right now the title of your project, and I walk them step by step. But they'd be using their project, right? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, you might even precede any of that because they don't really understand the value of the software. So you might even start with, and this you also mentioned in the book, so I don't want to steal your thunder here. You wrote in the book, you know, telling those success stories first. And I like what are called PAR stories, or before and after stories. So let's say at some other, you know, you start by saying, we've got this new software. I imagine the last thing you want to do is learn more. Your plate is already full. You say, why in the world do I need to learn this new software? Well, maybe it will help if I explain to you at one of our competitor companies, they've adopted software, and Mary Jo used to have to work until 8 or 9 o'clock at night to finish the damn things. And she found that because this thing that, you know, takes you so much time, the budgeting process or whatever, this has got this amazing automation tool that should be able to you to do that in half the time. So talking about those real-world stories, do you want to amplify on that concept, or is there not more to say about that?
Oh, I think so. You know, I mean, even if there's no practical way for people to bring their own problems, and I think there usually is, even giving them an interesting problem to solve that they're going to use the software to do at the beginning of it. I still remember a software training that I took in, boy, I want to say 1994, that had, it was a software training program on how to query databases. But the premise of it was you're an admin assistant, you've got a temporary job, you're hoping to make it permanent, everybody's left for the day, and the senior VP just called down and said, I need these sales numbers right away.
Great.
So now you have a task you have to accomplish to query these databases instead of just learning the technical details of querying databases.
Right, and you get to be the hero of your own story because there you did it and then that temp job became a permanent one and all that other stuff. Anyway,
yeah,
you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Julie Dirksen. We're talking about how to do learning on the job because these days who's got the time and money to go back to school and not to mention learning all, you know, not earning any money while you're learning. Let's give you, my dear listeners, a chance to ask a question or two. If you have a specific learning issue that you are facing or you're trying to get your supervisees to learn, this is the time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Julie, there's often a gap, though. You know, all these nice little pat stories work so well in theory and in books, but that's not the real world. There's often a big gap, Grand Canyon-sized gap, between how an idea should work in theory and what happens in the real world, what you call in the book the tacit issues. What kind of impediments get in the way, and how might... Let's pick one. Pick one impediment that might get in the way, and how might you be... What's some non-obvious way that you might address it?
Right. Well, there are certain types of learning where you get to the point where, you know, we can say, well, you know, you're going to do root cause analysis until you determine the root cause. I was working on a project like that, and they said, well, you stop when you get to the root cause. And I'm like, okay, well, how do they know when they get to the root cause? And these experts in the room just looked at me, and he said, well, you just kind of know. Hmm. And I'm like, great, because that's not hard to explain to a novice at all, right? And so we have all these things where we sort of send these examples out into the universe. You're supposed to do this. You're supposed to foster teamwork or something in right. your team, right?
Right?
But what does that actually look like in terms of real behaviors? And so it turns out that a lot of those kinds of things, these sort of hand-wavy grand statements, the way that you really learn to do those things is you see a lot of examples. And the problem is that sometimes you don't get the opportunity to see enough examples. You know, if you've ever been the hiring manager, you know what you like and don't like about resumes because you have looked at a lot of resumes. But if you're the job seeker, you may have only ever looked at your own resume and maybe a few other samples. And so you're not actually getting enough feedback about what works and what doesn't work because you haven't seen enough cases of it.
Yeah.
So that's a learning issue, especially these sort of subtler things that are kind of hard to describe, but you know it when you see it. Then the goal really becomes, how do I see enough case examples mm-hmm. that I start to recognize the patterns and I start to understand what really constitutes a good example versus a bad example?
That makes good sense. You know, when I think, though, about a gap between theory and practice, I'm really thinking about the sexual harassment stuff in the workplace. You know, every single person these days in any kind of an organization of size gets a sexual harassment workshop. And everybody mm-hmm. just intuitively knows you don't grope. And yet,
right.
you know, whether it's Al Franken or it's Roy Moore or it's Harvey Weinstein or anybody else, everybody knows they shouldn't do it, but they do it anyway. What the hell do we do about that issue?
Well, you know, honestly, I think a lot of that goes back to the earlier thing we discussed, which is everybody knows you're not supposed to do it, but nobody received any consequences for doing it for a really long time.
Oh, they're going to receive some consequences for this, I can mm-hmm. guarantee. Harvey Weinstein, yeah. I mean, there have been sex scandals forever. From when I was growing up as a little boy, there was the Profumo scandal. Some guy who I think he was a lord, some prime minister, semi-prime minister person. Well, he lost his job. There have been sex. Gary Hart, the guy who brought, he was the bimbo eruption. Or no, Bill Clinton with his bimbo. People pay an enormous price. And they still don't learn. What's the mm-hmm. deal?
Well, you know, more people got away with it than didn't get away with it.
I guess there's some truth to that. And I guess, you know, we dismiss the power of the impulse, whether in some cases these abusers are abusers of power, some it could be sexual. Who knows what the heck it is? But, you know, at the risk of, you know, public radio tends to be sanctimonious. We're all very high and mighty. But the reality, we all have human frailties of a variety of sort, and we can do all the training in the world sometimes, and mm-hmm. it's certainly justified and right training, but humans make errors. The Bible,
yeah.
You know, I'm not a religious person, but the Bible certainly talks about how fallible we all are, and we are. So
yeah, I was wondering if we needed more of like a truth and reconciliation hearing once all the sexual harassment stuff kind of settles out.
Well, I hear about the truth and reconciliation in South Africa. There is as much enmity now between the whites and blacks after the, I can't say exactly the same, but there's tremendous enmity. I'm actually on the radio all the time in Cape Town, South Africa, of all things. And believe me, there is plenty of racial tension there. Anyway, but I think I'd like to end on a more positive note. So let me throw you a softball to end this. If
okay.
there was one other thing that you wanted to tell my listeners that's not obvious, that would help them do a better job of learning in the workplace or helping their coworkers or supervisees learn in the workplace, what would that one thing be?
I think it really is that practice of setting up your own little experiments and looking for feedback on the actions that you take and trying to figure out, how do I get some measure of feedback. You know, we've used the job hunting example. Job hunting's terrible for feedback, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know why your resume got refused. You
or
don't
ignored.
Know why.
You're ignored all the time.
Yeah. So the issue of trying to figure out, what can I do to shed a little bit of light on whether it's somebody coaching me or whether it's some way of measuring the results of actions that I take, but what can I do to get myself a better feedback loop so that I can improve what I'm doing.
Absolutely. Anyway, Julie Dirksen, thanks a lot for being my guest and work with Marty Nemko. Her book is Second Edition, Design for How People Learn, and her website is usablelearning.com. Thanks for staying up so late. You're in the Midwest. It's nice of you to do that.
Yes, thank you so much.
Take care, Julie. Bye. By the way, in terms of getting that feedback for job seekers, I did want to share something with you, my dear listeners. I tell my clients all the time that it's not enough to ask and say, you know, can you tell me why I didn't get the job? Because they think they're just going to open a can of worms, it's going to start an argument or whatever. I do encourage, if you don't, especially if you've been interviewed once or twice for this particular job, and then you get either the great silence or you get a form letter rejection, we decided to go in another direction, somebody's got a better skill set. You know, that's usually just, you know, CYA stuff. It's wise to pick up the phone, even if you have to leave voicemail, and say, I, of course, am disappointed I didn't get this job. And I am not trying to argue with it, because I understand you probably were very careful in making the decision. But as I move forward in other applications, I'm wondering if you might be willing to tell me a little bit about the truth about why I didn't get the job and what I might do differently when I pursue other jobs. That is more likely, no guarantees in this world, but that's more likely to get you feedback. And even because you were so gracious about it and not defensive and open to growing and learning, stranger things have happened than that their number one prospect fell through, or there's some other job that they invite you to apply for. And these days, a lot of jobs get filled by people who are invited to apply. That brings me to another important point. The passivity approach has often failed in job search, just answering ads. Generally, it becomes semi-lottery odds. The key is to get yourself, and this is the thing, we live in an online world where ever more jobs are gotten by employers inviting people to apply, either somebody you already know through your network or creating an excellent digital presence on the internet. Being active in your LinkedIn or Yahoo group forums, that's really important, because recruiters, both internal recruiters and headhunters, will troll those forums to look for people who make intelligent comments. Blog. Follow thought leaders in your field and make useful comments. Tweet. Follow people whose Twitter feed are thought leaders. Make comments. Those are the ways in which, in today's world, and increasingly in tomorrow's world, you're more likely to get plucked out instead of being some anonymous person who submits his or her so carefully little tweaked resume and cover letter with the right search terms in the keywords in the resume. That is 1990s and 2000-aughts, or whatever they call that. The 2017s to 2020s is more about getting yourself plucked. And that's a good time for me actually to invite you to call in. If you have a work-related problem of any sort, whether you're unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, whether you are at an entry-level job or a very senior position, for-profit, non-profit, government, I can usually help. The price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada. I call them workovers. This is the time to call while the lines are available and you don't have to sit and wait on the phone. You know, it's late at night already. If you're in your car, you don't want to be sitting on, you want to be listening to the music or whatever. You want to get on the air right away. This is the time to call. Or if you're home, you still probably don't want to spend a lot of time waiting. The phone number here for a workover here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I thought, this is only my third week at my new time Thursday nights. I thought I'd go back to basics. The basics really are, people like to know about careers that are under the radar. They may not have thought of, whether it be for themselves or somebody they care about. So I want to start by offering a few careers for people, and then a few maybe for STEM people, you know, science, math, technology, engineering, technology, and a few for hands-on people, in hopes of somewhere in that buffet, there's something that might tweak your interest or that of someone you care about. So the first career I'd like to talk about in terms of careers for people, is something called a foundation program officer. Foundations, of course, give away money, and the person in charge of both maybe writing the grant proposal, the request for proposal, soliciting the kind of programs that the foundation wants to fund, or pick among the ones who are applying or supervise the grant receiver so that to provide what necessary support. That's a very cool job. And it's called Foundation Program Officer. It's not easy to get. I'm not going to say this is an entry-level job. It is a job that you normally get plucked for, or you get somebody who's going to get you an in. But it's a wonderful job. People really love being a Foundation Program Officer. And here in the Bay Area, we have so many foundations, from the Fleischhacker Foundation to the Pew Charitable Trust. There's tons of them. That's a great job for somebody who is really well connected, because it is often mainly a soft skill job. It's people, organization, common sense, which may not be so common. Great career, Foundation Program Officer. Another example of a people-centric career is a student affairs administrator. No, I'm not referring to steamy dorm room hookups. Colleges employ people, many of them without doctorates, to develop and administer programs for orientation, for extracurricular activity, for housing. And a college campus is a really stimulating work environment, and the academic year is short. So great career. Very few people grow up thinking, oh, when I grow up, I want to be a student affairs administrator. But that is a great under-the-radar, people-centric career that I encourage you to consider, or for yourself or for somebody you love. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I invite you to call for a workover. Good time to call is now. Phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to give out one more career for people before I turn to careers for STEM people, science and math types. And that is a counselor in an adoption agency. Government agencies are hiring counselors, I don't know right at the moment, but they do hire counselors to do the often emotionally rewarding, although sometimes wrenching work, of matching prospective parents with children, and also counseling those parents, as well as the birth parents. Also, private agencies may do that. They may specialize, for example, in international adoptions. One more people-centric career, I need to do it. A little lower-level job, may not be so hard to get, is something called a field interviewer. Many companies and nonprofits and government agencies, they hire interviewers. A company might use one to run focus groups or observe people and then interview them that are using their product. Like Whirlpool might send you into people's homes to see how they use their refrigerator, their stove, their microwave. A nonprofit or government agency might send you into a low-income neighborhood to interview people about what they perceive as impediments to employment. And it can be interesting work, but frankly, the pay is pretty low to be a kind of long-term sustainable thing. But it could be a launch pad into other careers like market researcher or community relations manager or data analyst, maybe somebody developing those surveys that the field interviewers use. Anyway, phone number again for workover if you want one, 415-841-4134 here at Work with Marty Nemko. Let's go to the phones. It's your turn on the air. What is on your mind? How can I help? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's here. You. Yeah. So how can I help you? What's on your mind?
You know, I was curious about kind of getting something that most people don't think about, but a lot of people want to pay for.
Okay, you're speaking more generally. Pay for, I need to, because I'm assuming you're looking for a business for yourself to start or something like that, is that correct?
Yeah, because, you know, all these guys, they're all doing it, but not every man is getting paid for it. And I think that, you know, people would pay good money to watch me touch myself.
I'm gonna comment off the air. It's an interesting general question. I didn't particularly appreciate the touch myself story, but I do think it's fair to say that that's kind of a core question. What is something non-obvious that people would pay a lot for? And the answer really comes from not in the abstract, but by talking to people with the power to pay. And very often the people are not individuals, but businesses. Very often there are unmet needs that a business has. They've got the money, and you on the outside may not be able to think about, may not think of what they might need. For example, a nonprofit lawyer may need somebody to oh, go in the field and gather information of some sort. I don't know. But it's usually smart to take a field that you know something about already, so you're not a virgin and you may already have connections in that industry. And asking them and say, you know, what is making your life difficult? What is, what kind of a product or service could make your life easier? I love telling the story of at a Christmas party, there was somebody, this was in New York, and there was a guy talking to somebody who ended up being some kind of a director or manager at Conrail, which is runs a railroad, an industrial railroad, on both sides of the Hudson River, that is between New York and New Jersey. And he happened to mention, maybe he was asked, I don't know, that they spend $20,000 a month on cab fares, having employees ferried across from the New York side of the Hudson River to the New Jersey side. And so this person who was asking the question or was in this conversation was looking for work, and he proposed and submitted a formal proposal to have a van that would every 20 minutes cross the George Washington Bridge to ferry the employees from one side to the other and then back, enabling the company to save a lot of money and for him to have a very kind of a low-key, pretty easy way to make a living. And so really talking to the potential customer, especially on the in the business side where there may be deeper pockets, may be a way to find an unmet need. So give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, the phone number for a free workover, of course, everything here at KALW, is for you. This is my pro bono work. I do charge a reasonable amount during the week. I'm a career coach, but this is my pro bono work, and I do it for you. So the phone number here for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I promise that after having given a few of those people careers for people, that I was going to turn to careers for people who are STEM people, science, technology, engineering, and math. Let me start by doing that. One of my favorites in that area that's, again, under the radar is something called program evaluator. And I think what I'd rather do, I'd like to prioritize you. I will tell you what a program evaluator is, et cetera, but we've got callers on the line, so I want to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So it is your turn on the air. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. How can I help you? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I actually had a question for one of my nieces. Mm-hmm. She was arrested, and she's been actually arrested a couple times, but she seems to be getting her stuff in order. It's very hard for people like that to find jobs.
Yes.
What do you suggest that they go about in doing to kind of get their stuff together, like present themselves more reliable, et cetera?
Great question. I love it to death. First of all, we could start with the legal thing and see if there is legally possible for it to get expunged, if she sounds like she's maybe young. But let's put that aside for the moment. I am a believer, and the older I get, the more I've been doing this career counseling thing, the more I have become an adherent to radical honesty. So I'm going to role play. And if I were her, and of course she's not going to start and get a superstar job, but if she's got a couple of, give me an example of a kind of launch pad job, entry level job she would try to get. And I'll try to be very concrete and tell you exactly how I'd handle it.
She likes to do various things with, like, IT stuff, like computers, gaming. She's kind of young. She's in her 20s.
Okay.
And so she applies for all this various stuff, like, with IT, but never even really gets beyond.
Right.
She's honest. She's honest in the fact that, you know, they ask, have you ever been arrested?
She's not going to get a job that way in IT. They're so formal and so afraid of lawsuits or whatever. Now, sometimes they can't. There are certain growing possibilities that it may be impossible, or it may not be an automatic rejection if you've had a felony or whatever. But let's assume that what has happened to her, that is, that she gets rejected all the time because of that, gets her in trouble. So what I would do is, her first job is probably not going to be by answering an ad. I would have her make a list, and perhaps you make a list, of the people who like her or like you, even if they have nothing to do with IT. She's got to get something on her record that shows that she did a good job. I don't care if she's a warehouse woman. I don't care if she's cleaning houses. I don't care, you know, anything, maybe not an Uber driver, because, hey, you lose money as an Uber driver and you're not going to get references as an Uber driver, but some kind of an entry-level job, whatever it is. And I would tell all of the people in my network and her network who like her and say, you know what, it's time for me to grow up. I've made some bad calls. Just like those UCLA basketball players who went in China, you know, shoplifted sneakers, expensive sneakers, I believe. You know, they got on, their PR people from UCLA got on the, you know, wrote them a script. They all read their script. They said, I'm really sorry for what I did. I made bad judgment. But in the end, that's the right thing to do. And to say that I made some bad judgment calls, I really am ready to grow up. I need somebody to give me a fresh start. Perhaps somebody gave you a fresh start. I'm willing to work my way up from the bottom. I'm not expecting, after having committed my two felonies or whatever, that you're going to hire me to be a rock star. I'm willing to do whatever, work my way up from the bottom. Might you know somebody in a position to give me an entry-level launchpad job? That's what I would do, and I'd say it again and again and again. And at that level, I might even, on a retail basis, does she look, you implied that she may not look so presentable. Could she be cleaned up to look presentable?
You know, many of the young people today have, like, the tattoos and the piercings.
I'm not so worried about tattoos and piercings. You know, I shop at Trader Joe's. I love it. And it seems like about a third of the people there have tattoos and piercings. What she needs to look is clean and neat. And if she...
That's fine.
Then maybe even as an entry, you know, if she can clean herself up, and a lot of workplaces, we're in the Bay Area. This is not Wyoming. There are going to be lot of... Go ahead.
She's not in the Bay Area, though. I tell her to come out here all the time, but she's not.
Where is she?
Kansas.
Not exactly the land of avant-garde. But, you know, the whatever avant-garde exists tends to be in around liberal universities like the University of Kansas in Lawrence. So if she were open or Olathe, you know, one of the places that are more, anyway, a place that tends to be more liberal, she might, as a starting place, she might simply go into local retailers that are edgy, art supply stores, bookstores, progressive makeup and hair salon places. Maybe there's the kind of place that she could, maybe her looks could even be an advantage. You know, I'm not saying she should work in a tattoo parlor, but working, but working in some kind of a place where her ethos is to be respected, and at least is not a minus, to tell her story and to show that she's willing to work for, and maybe even say, would you hire me on a trial of a fill-in basis? You know, when you get, let's say, I'm just thinking about, let's say, I get my hair cut at Supercuts on College. There's somebody who basically just answers the phone and cleans up the hair. Well, they may need substitutes. It's not a glamorous job. It's not going to pay well. But if she could get a job in a place like that and she shows up reliably and she's got a good attitude, that can be a launch pad. You don't go from felon to superstar in one sleep. We do it in baby steps like everything else in life. So does any of that make sense for her?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can pass that on.
All right. Well, while I'm ahead, thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. I wish her the best of luck.
Thanks. Great.
Thank you. Let's go back right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
My name is Cynthia.
Hi, Cynthia.
I have an acquaintance, a woman who is wanting to go into a managerial position, but her supervisor calls her things like honey and girl and asks her to do stupid things like make coffee. Mm-hmm. And she's getting different advice. You know, some people are saying, just let it pass over, it's okay. And other people are saying, you need to take a stand. You need to make your position known that's not right to do it.
I think I want to comment in this way.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's symptomatic. You know, if the diminution is simply sexist, it's one thing. But if it maybe he doesn't respect her, maybe her judgment isn't good, maybe she's not that reliable or whatever, then maybe she needs to first look inward. Or people really, if I'm really being honest, although counselors seem to imply that everybody is infinitely malleable, people don't change very much. You're not going to change. If she wants to take a stand and go sue the guy or file claims with the EEOC or whatever, that's one thing. But she, if she's not going to go that route, she either needs to make an ascertainment that her, that all the diminution isn't, you know, it may be yucky to be called honey or whatever. When I go to an old-fashioned diner, they call me honey too. To look inward and see if the problem at least partially resides in her, or if it resides elsewhere and she doesn't want to sue, then, and she's got managerial chops, if she's got the, and we, as we were talking about earlier with the guest, if she's got the ability to inspire, the ability to do strategic planning, she's got enough technical chops to be able to interpret data or whatever, she's able to hire well and whatever, then she should look for a managerial job elsewhere. Or if she feels she could develop those chops, she should do a managerial boot camp, a short course on Udemy, or that they offer all those kind of management courses on Udemy, and armed with that new training, go and try to find a job, or even go whole hog and get an MBA. After all, MBA stands for Master's in Business Administration. Do any of those feel right for her?
I don't think that suing was on the table. It was just a question of whether she should be open, radical honesty with him and tell her what she thinks.
No, that's going to yield defensiveness. I don't think that. No.
And not worrying about it so much.
If it's not a matter of principle and it's a matter of exigency, I don't think telling a baby, boss, don't call me honey anymore is going to be of any help. He's going to look for other ways to find fault with her. I don't think the upside is worth that unless she's taking a political stand. I think she's either got to, A, look inward and say, do I have the, is his diminution of me, does he treat everybody, is every woman like that? Or is
my understanding, it's kind of how, he does treat, I guess, the other women in the company.
Okay,
if
he does that.
And they ask them to do the more menial tasks.
Okay, well, if that is characterological and he's a sexist pig, then probably and if she's not wanting to be about, take a stand in principle and go to HR and call them on it and have, she could organize all the women and the women can empower, women in group go to him or his boss and cite chapter and verse and get him fired. That can happen if she wants, but I'm inferring from what you're saying that's not the direction she wants to take. So
right.
That's why I'm suggesting if she, whether she does or not, it's certainly not a bad idea to look inward, and whether she, if she feels she's not only wants to be a manager, but has those attributes that I just described, then she's not going to get anywhere with this guy. It seems like if he's making all the women do menial tasks, he's like out of the 1950s, it seems like it's the wrong workplace. She's got to either see if she can get a transfer to another boss, find another workplace, because it sounds like she's not willing to accept her current role, and frankly, I probably wouldn't either. Does that make sense?
Well, it certainly does make sense.
What am I missing, though?
I think I was just hoping for, maybe a third way or, kind of a wiser way, and maybe there isn't a third way.
I think it's too risky. I mean, I'd be BSing you if I said, she could gently talk to him and say, I'm feeling a little concerned that you're relegating me to these low-level tasks and all the other women as well and calling me baby and honey and whatever. I'm wondering if you might see your way clear to giving me a shot at management. I mean, I could go that route, but I don't believe it would work. Anything can work sometimes, but statistically, I'm betting against that. Anyway,
sobering.
Well, I like to be as straight as I can. I try to err on the side of optimism where I can, but I'd rather be pessimistic than not give you my fairest, most realistic shot.
Yeah. So, radical honesty in certain circumstances, but
that's
not
right.
In others.
We don't always disclose everything. I have my weaknesses, and there are certain things I should be disclosing on this radio show and certain things I don't. We try to use good judgment as to how candid we can be. I mean, if I see somebody who's got an attribute, let's say somebody who's working for me, and he or she is just not going to be able to fix it, it's built into him or her, and and I'm not going to fire that person. It is wise for me to shut up and look for the ways to use that person's strengths or whatever. We have to use good judgment. It doesn't, my doggy doesn't have impulse control. My doggy wants his food now. My doggy wants to go out now. But we do need to exercise a certain amount of judgment and restraint. It's easy for me to do it on the radio where I'm under no stress. In the heat of the battle of the workplace, it's not so easy. But certainly, every police officer has got to use discretion. How confrontive to be?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to take a look at your own position, too, and determine what your bargaining power is and what your needs are, you know, your income and that type.
Right. How much bargaining power do you have? And how sure are you right? You know, I found that many people have this inordinate sense that they are right without having looked inward enough. That's why I'm balancing the looking outward with the looking inward. There are many people who have an inordinate self-confidence that far exceeds their competence. And so I'm trying to strike the balance, because I don't know her. I'm trying to strike the balance between looking out externally and looking inward. Because there are some, believe me, there have been plenty of people who are good individual contributors, and then they get promoted to manager and they fall on their face. So the balance of external and inward is probably the right way for me to respond.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I have just a minute or two. I promised people that I would offer science and math careers. I have time for just one, and maybe I even have time for one phone call. I'll give you all I can. Program evaluators, where I was starting. Appropriately, ever more innovative programs are getting evaluated to identify ways to improve them, to determine if funding should be continued, should it be increased, should it be cut. And disproportionately, the programs are evaluated are in education, psychology, and social services. So if those are of interest to you and getting to, you know, you do have to know basic statistics, basic experimental design, but you don't need to be an advanced statistician. It's usually not needed, and if it does, it gets outsourced to statisticians. What you really need is the ability to quickly size up what's happening in a program that's based on data and observation and human interaction, and you have to have the ability to get that program staff and their clients to trust you. It's really crucial if you expect to get valid information. And then program evaluators usually finish a project by presenting the results, verbally or in writing. I think it's a wonderful field because you get immersed in innovation after innovation. And if you're good, you play a key role in determining how a program might be improved and in ensuring that future dollars are spent wisely. I have a minute left. Let me see if I can give a quick answer to somebody. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Quickly ask your question. Are you there?
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. Hi. Well, I guess my main question is, I'm the sole proprietor of a landscape design and installation company, and I'm trying to figure out how to go forward expanding my business.
I'm going to interrupt you because of time. My two answers jumped to mind.
You're going to run out of time.
So two things, two quick answers. One is to specialize. I wouldn't go the xeriscaping, dry landscaping. That's been done, and maybe hopefully the drought is over. But I would focus on irrigation systems. There's a real shortage of that, and it's a high profit margin. So I maybe focus on that, or I would find a person who I would train to be my mentee. And if that person was sales-oriented, I would teach him or her to go out and sell. If that person was more installation-oriented, I would teach the person the ins and outs of installation. And that really is all the time for today. Feel free, if that was an inadequate answer, and it probably was,
feel free. Some of it is good, but it doesn't completely apply. I've been doing this for like 12 years, so it's been a great business. I'm just trying to figure out whether I should hire people or...
Try a person on a trial basis and see how that feels. And if that's inadequate, call back next week. I'm not going anywhere. All right? Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7, the new time here for Work with Marty Nemco. By the way, special thanks to those of you who have followed me from Sunday, where I've been for 28 years. I'm delighted to be here Thursdays at 7. Anyway, I'm going to talk about what it's really like to be a songwriter, not because I'm one, but I'm going to talk to Paul Zolo. He's America's premier writer about songwriters. He wrote the book, Songwriters on Songwriting. He's interviewed everybody from Paul Simon to Paul Williams, Ringo Starr to Sia. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.